From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a bird's eye view of high water.
We are actually recording history because the water level has exceeded record levels. So we are experiencing something that people have never seen.
We get a pilot's view of erosion along the lakes. Also on the show, Michigan's clerks feel nervous about counting a flood of absentee ballots. We'll talk through the plan with a member of the State Senate Elections Committee.
We need to be prepared for little hiccups. As long as we maintain the integrity, we're going to have to be very patient.
Can Michigan afford to wait a few days? Also, filmmaker Sean O'Grady talks about navigating Sundance and streaming services.
If someone wants to watch it on their laptop, that's fantastic. If someone wants to watch it in a theater, that's fantastic too. Whatever means gets it to the most people who might connect with it, that's the avenue I'm supporting.
That's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, Michigan's county clerks are expecting a flood of absentee ballots for election year. Many clerks are asking lawmakers to step in and allow for some tabulation to be done ahead of time. And that might happen, but one lawmaker wants to know, what if we just cooled it and tabulated the votes slowly? Ed McBroom joins us in a few. But first, we want to talk about the rising lake levels that have been wreaking havoc on Michigan's Great Lakes shorelines. Those images of private homes teetering on eroding bluffs, we've all seen them. They're really dramatic. But you should see them from Randy Claypool's point of view. He's the owner of Truly Michigan Aerial out of Muskegon. Mr. Claypool, welcome to Stateside.
Hi there.
You've been doing aerial photography for, what, about 5 years now?
About 5 years now, yes.
What kind of places do you fly over, and who are you flying for?
Well, we pretty much dedicated our company to creating movies and documentaries of Michigan, so we fly over the entire state of Michigan.
And are you mostly just making your own films, or is this sometimes for people who need the footage for their own uses?
A little of both. We create our own movies and documentaries. We're self-funded. We do not sponsor or anything like that. It's always been my lifelong passion to own a business with airplanes and to create movies. So it just seems like Michigan is a great backdrop for it.
What are you seeing up there as of, say, last fall and this winter around the edge of the lake?
Well, when we started to do our documentary in June, it was actually June 5th we began filming. We started filming from St. Joseph, and we followed north along the shoreline, and we were starting to see hints of erosion. And then throughout the year to follow, we heard about the erosion. So December 5th, which was actually 6 months to the day later, we filmed from South Haven to Fishtown Leland, and the erosion was pretty dramatic. And the most dramatic areas, of course, were the high bluffs where the waves could eat at the bottom and create the erosion. And we saw houses, you know, on the edge of the hills and whole trees that had fallen from the cliffs right down to the beach, stuff like that.
Wow. Have you compared the newer footage with the older clips to see if the change really is as pronounced as that reaction tells you?
We have. In fact, we've taken photos and compared them from June 5th to December 5th, and just dramatic changes.
Do you ever see people working on their homes trying to salvage them or repair the damage?
What we've seen is several excavating companies have actually put their excavators right in the water, right in Lake Michigan, to, you know, move boulders around and make seawalls and things like that.
That's a thing?
I didn't know it was. It was pretty extraordinary to actually see that equipment in Lake Michigan, but I guess that's what they do.
I'm guessing a lot of what you do comes from wanting to show people all those places along the waterline in Michigan. And you live near the shoreline, too.
Yes.
What is it like to look down and see all those houses and roads overwhelmed?
It's pretty sad. And we also realize we are actually recording history because the water level has exceeded record levels. So we are experiencing something that people have never seen.
Mm. You mentioned that this becomes an exercise in recording history. Is there anything that you can do to sort of formalize what you've seen in footage that you were gathering for yourself?
Well, we are cataloging all of this, and we plan on doing more missions when we can to record more.
Would you say that people who live in that part of the world are, you know, how they're feeling about all this right now?
From what I can gather, of course, they're very devastated, and it has to be. You know, a lot of people are actually moving their homes back if they can. away from the lake shore. And the other ones, unfortunately, are just losing their homes. We have heard through different meteorologists that the lake water is supposed to rise even more this year. They're saying up to 20 more inches. So that is very concerning. A lot of the inland lakes that are, you know, connected to Lake Michigan are experiencing high water levels as well. Some of the marinas, the docks are underwater. So there's an extensive line of damage from this.
Randy Claypool of Truly Michigan Aerial. We've been talking to him from his home in Muskegon. Thank you for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We have a 35-second clip of Randy's work. And if you check on the Stateside website a little bit later today, you can see for yourself what he's talking about. Now, the lakeshore erosion is also posing serious infrastructure challenges. Just on Monday, lawmakers and officials from several state departments, as well as the U.S. Coast Guard, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, got together in Lansing to talk about options for tackling the problem. Brad Wieferich is part of the state's first high water coordinating summit. He's the director of the Bureau of Development for the Michigan Department of Transportation, and he joins us now. Brad, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, from an infrastructure point of view, how bad is the problem?
It's getting pretty bad. At MDOT, we are tracking about 40 sites across the state on all four of the Great Lakes that touch the state of Michigan. And again, these are 40 sites on the roads that Michigan Department of Transportation has jurisdiction on.
Can you give us some examples within that of what you're dealing with? I mean, is it total collapse in all cases?
Not in all cases, no. There's actually kind of three categories that we have. One is the slope failures that I'm sure you've seen pictures of, not only the homes going in, but roads as well. M25 over in Sanilac County along the Thumb has some significant issues. You've probably seen the M185, which is the road around Mackinac Island,
right,
has had those issues. So we have the slope failure issues. We also have inundation issues where the water levels are simply coming up so high that they're either going to overtop the roadway, or the ditches and storm sewers that are intended to take water away from our roadways are backing up themselves. Plus, the volume of water that we're seeing in our rivers is also potentially going to be an issue for scour, which is the action of water flow around the piers and foundations, literally eroding away the materials that hold them in place.
Let's say we wanted to just turn back the clock and go to a point maybe 10 years ago where the roads in these areas were not impeded by lake levels. What is the range in cost that you think it would take to make repairs to get everything back to what people think of as normal?
So that's what we're trying to really get our arms around right now. We're in the very preliminary stages of trying to assess what our risk is. And from what we've gathered so far at these roughly 40 sites, we're going to spend about $5 million immediately just to get things passable and to keep things passable. But when you look at the long-term fixes, the things that we would need to do in order to repair all of these sites, you could be looking in the ballpark of around $100 million. So again, that's probably conservative, and that's not a real detailed estimate, kind of back of the napkin thing. But when you start thinking about the sizes of some of these slopes and the repairs that we'd have to make, or quite literally having to move the road inland, those costs can quickly add up.
You know, I feel like, please correct me if I'm wrong, this is probably above and beyond what the state is already talking about needing to truly address road repairs to the extent that they deserve.
You're absolutely right. You know, the money that would be needed to take care of these things is not something that we can go out and find. It has to come out of our existing budgets. So whether it's budgets that we have for our regular maintenance, or if it's money that we have currently programmed for road and bridge projects, we'd have to take it out of our existing budgets.
Well, I mean, every road fail is a problem for the people driving on it. How much does the erosion problem complicate the department's plans to address many other areas in need?
Well, kind of like anything else, when something that we weren't planning for pops up, it puts us in very reactionary mode. That's why it's important that when we have a sustainable funding source, we can go ahead and plan a few years out, use asset management to really pick the right projects at the right time. And when we're kind of throwing curveballs like this, we have to scramble in order to come up with the money, first of all, decide what's not going to get done so that we can ensure that these most critical issues get addressed.
As we mentioned, there were a lot of other parties at the table at the summit, the Army Corps, Department of Natural Resources. What kind of conversations were happening?
You know, it was interesting. I learned a lot. I learned a lot from the Army Corps. I learned a lot from Eagle. I learned a lot from the Weather Service folks that were able to kind of give us some of the data behind why we're seeing what we're seeing. So that was very interesting. In MDAR, the agricultural folks were there as well, talking about how saturated the soils are and from their perspective, how that limits the ability to get crops in. And that same saturation that you're seeing in the fields is also under our pavements.
Right.
And that, quite honestly, as an engineer, I'm anxious and concerned to see what happens this spring. We all know about potholes in the springs in the state of Michigan, and with even more water in the soil this year, I think we can expect to see plenty more.
Brad, we have less than a minute to go. I just wanted to ask, is this the new normal?
I'm not a hydrologist or a meteorologist. I don't know. And that's probably what makes this so difficult to plan. Like I said, when we have knowns and we're able to plan and be able to make the most sound decisions, we're at our best. Obviously, we're at our best right now because we're scrambling to make those good decisions as well. But we just don't know if it's the new normal. We have to plan for cases that we otherwise had not been planning for.
Brad Wiefrich is director of the Bureau of Development for Michigan's Department of Transportation. Thanks for checking in with us on this.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the show, a punk kid on the lam and the gal who's obsessed with his band go on an epic journey through America's decaying suburbs. We'll talk with the executive producer of Dinner in America about making film in Michigan.
In LA or New York in particular, people are so sick of filming that they just want you out. Like, you've got 12 hours to shoot, get out in 12 hours. Here, it's more like, oh, you need an extra day? Yeah, sure, hang out.
That's coming up on Stateside. Stay with us. You're with Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Bear. Now that the Oscars are over, we've got something to put on your radar for the months to come. It's a new feature film made in Michigan, ready for distribution. The film is called Dinner in America, and it premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The movie was directed by Adam Raymeyer and shot in Metro Detroit, made with the local production company Atlas Industries. Executive producer Sean O'Grady, also a Michigan native, is Atlas's founder and a filmmaker in his own right. He joins us to talk about the film and the Sundance experience. Sean O'Grady, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you want to tell us the story of how you met Adam Raymeyer?
I've known Adam for a very long time. Adam's wife, now wife, Sarah Raymeyer, is from Saginaw, Michigan, where I'm also from. And I moved to LA to try to make it in the film business and knew one person, and that was Sarah. And I didn't really want to rely on her to break into the industry. So I had this other job. I hated it. I was freaking out. I was going to move back to Michigan, live in the woods. I don't know what I was going to do. And I called Sarah, told her this. I was like, I'm done with this business. I'm done with this town. I'm out of here. And she said, wait a minute. My boyfriend Adam is about to start working on two movies this summer. Maybe he can get you a job as a PA. So Adam vouched for me, having never met me. Got that PA job, and every single job I've had since in the industry has led directly from that first PA job.
The rest of the story is a weird, heavily Midwestern-influenced episode of Entourage.
Yes, very much so.
Okay. Obviously, like you mentioned, Adam's not from Michigan, but his wife is. Was it a hard sell for him to think about making Dinner in America here?
No, he actually wrote it from Michigan. He sent it to me maybe 6 years ago and said, hey, I think this is something we could do either in Saginaw or in Detroit for a pretty low price point. What do you think? And it took the time between then and now to build the team and get all the people necessary to actually make that happen.
Right. Dinner in America is about a guy named Simon, and he's in a band. And to make a long story short, he gets in a spot and needs to start relying on his band's super fan, Patty. And it's like a – it has elements of a mini road movie, but it's also very much a – it feels like a period piece of suburban Michigan. And the places in Saginaw and Detroit that you're with in the film kind of inhabit them the same way that scenes in Southern California inhabit the films of Greg Araki. What's in here that you recognize?
As far as locations?
Yeah, and just how people are with each other?
I think there's a misunderstanding of one another that people have in the movie, and I think that creates a lot of the conflict. And I don't know how much of that just comes from Adam's actual experience growing up in the Midwest in Nebraska, or if that comes from just adolescence. People put up these walls and they don't want to be vulnerable. They don't want to let each other in. And I think that leads to a lot of problems, especially for people like Patty and Simon, who maybe live a little outside of, I guess, what would be considered cultural norms.
They're both the kids. They're the punk kids in the room for sure. But also in just how they seem to react to things differently than everybody in the rest of the film do. The dinner table scenes form an important center of this film. It's called Dinner in America, but there are a number of pivotal things that happen at dinner tables in this film. Do you know anything about how Adam came to focus on that?
I think it was unintentional. I think that he realized that after he was writing it, because it started off, he was writing two different scripts. One followed Patty, one followed Simon, and neither script was working. So at some point, he's like, oh, if I put these two characters' journeys together, what happens when these people who really have no business being around one another meet and go on this journey together? So I think at a certain point, he just realized that he'd written all these dinner scenes and that it was kind of creating a theme.
Yeah, there's a lot to work with there in terms of punk kids and their parents who don't understand and can't figure out why their kids are acting so weird. Everyone's awkward Thanksgiving nightmare writ incredibly large. In working with Adam on this film and your other recent projects, do you feel like it gets any easier to keep projects on time and on budget?
That's always a challenge. I think, fortunately, being Michigan-based filmmakers, it is a lot easier for us to keep things on budget just because things don't cost as much. So if you go over a little on time or you go over, it's not as big of an issue. Like, particularly when it comes to locations. That's my favorite thing about filming in Michigan is people are excited to have you at their home. They're excited to have you with their business. In LA or New York in particular, people are so sick of filming that they just want you out. Like, you've got 12 hours to shoot, get out in 12 hours. Here, it's more like, oh, you need an extra day? Yeah, sure, hang out.
Here's hoping that keeps going.
Yeah, definitely.
Would you tell us a little bit about maybe something that happened on location for Dinner in America that posed a challenge and how you dealt with it?
Well, locations tend to not be exactly what you think they're going to be. So what happens is you go on a scout and you take your crew there. You see what you're going to need in terms of equipment, manpower, et cetera, to turn the location into what you want it to be on film. And all that sounds really great in theory until you actually start putting those things in place. And locations tend to be smaller than you remember them once you have 15 people in the room or once you have 20 people in the room.
Cameras, lights, sound equipment.
Yeah, they tend to be smaller and hotter than you remember them. So one thing I remember happening, it's actually the basement where the sort of pivotal song in the film is recorded. There was, I forget whether it was a humidor or like a wine cellar, but there was some sort of climate-controlled contraption in the basement. And that's a very quiet, intimate moment in the film. And about every 20 seconds, that device would beep very, very loudly. Just the kind of thing you don't plan on, because you don't plan on, when you scout, the AC is on. So the whatever the device is doesn't have to beep to let you know that the temperature is changing. It's not supposed to be. So that's just one of those things that you don't know until you know.
What did you do? Just unplug the thing?
John Covert, one of the producers of the film, actually just threw like a big furniture pad over it, and it fortunately kept the sound low enough that the microphones weren't picking it up anymore.
How was the experience of taking the film to a festival?
It was fantastic. there were really no expectations for this film at the festival. No one knew anything about it, and that was very much kind of by design. We felt that this film was really best discovered by an audience, and it played really well. People loved it. I know by the end, sort of Adam and Kyle and Emily were getting mobbed anywhere they would go. The Q&As were really fun. People were really engaged, and I think that I think it's just the kind of movie that plays well in a theater to an audience and to people who are there to experience something they haven't experienced before.
You've worked on projects that were intended for theatrical release first and maybe foremost, and also projects that went straight to streaming. What's your approach when you go to a place like Sundance with a film like Dinner in America? Who are you trying to find?
First and foremost, you're trying to find an audience that loves the film. You're trying to get people to watch it who can review it. And fortunately, those reviews have been really good. And in some cases, you know, sometimes you have distribution for a film prior to taking it to the festival, which means you know what the plan's going to be for release. And sometimes you don't. So those are the different things that you might look for in any number of those scenarios.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with executive producer Sean O'Grady. He's also a Michigan native, the founder of Atlas Industries and filmmaker in his own right. The most recent film he's produced, Dinner in America, was just exhibited at the Sundance Film Festival. I imagine that the politics of the situation have just changed a lot in recent years. Obviously, you want people to see it, and you want them to enjoy it, and then maybe get some interest that might lead to some sort of distribution deal. But the streaming services have caught a little flack for buying popular titles at festivals like Sundance, taking them, but not really doing anything to promote them when they get released. So then the producer and the director are sort of right back to square one in terms of having to do all their own marketing and, you know, build a reputation for their film. How do you feel about what streaming services have to offer?
Our previous films have mostly been theatrical, and then they've gone to streaming services later. And the first project we had that went directly to a streaming service was Living Undocumented, which premiered in October. And that was fantastic. I thought there was tons of press that we got that drove people to the film.
You had a good experience.
We had a great experience.
Yeah.
And so I'm very pro streaming. I think that personally, while I love seeing films in theaters, I love that sort of communal experience, I also don't necessarily think it's fair for filmmakers to dictate where the film gets seen. I think that if someone wants to watch it on their laptop, that's fantastic. If someone wants to watch it in a theater, that's fantastic too. So for me, whatever means gets it to the most people who might connect with it, that's the avenue I'm supporting.
Streaming has been a huge boon for, I want to say, just about everybody in production. I mean, if you talk to actors and designers and things, there's just more work being done because there's more places where work product can be seen. But I do wonder about how it's working out for producers with fewer deals for more money on the really high-profile projects that can make your production company viable over the long run.
Well, it's actually interesting. So it's opened up, it's reopened up sort of the middle market where I think a lot of the best movies are made. There was a good, like almost my entire career, people have been saying you can't make like the $10 to $20 million independent dramas. There's no market for it anymore. There's basically really small movies and superhero movies. And now you're seeing with the proliferation of streaming services, those middle market sort of adult dramas are coming back again. And so that's really exciting to me. So both from a business viability standpoint and from a creative standpoint, I think that what's happened with streaming has just been fantastic for producers.
Do you have any advice for other producers who might be trying to figure out how to negotiate?
Bring something to the table that nobody has to offer. Right? Tell an original story. That's
awesome.
The thing.
Okay, no problem. What else does the company have in development right now? Is there anything you can tell us about?
Yeah, we have a few things. We have a couple documentaries that are in production right now. We also have a movie that we're making that we're taking sort of an interesting approach to. So it's a horror anthology film that we're going to release this upcoming Halloween. The goal is we want to release it in Michigan theaters Halloween weekend, and we are using all Michigan filmmakers for it. So this is the kind of thing where we do think it will attract an international audience, but we're also making it specifically for this audience here.
That's fascinating. You know, the alt horror film festival circuit has picked up some steam. And I honestly do not know if they're, you know, if that means anything different in terms of how films eventually get distributed. But man, I mean, that just wasn't even a thing in festivals for so long. You know, you couldn't get those kinds of, it felt like you couldn't get those kinds of films taken very seriously.
Yeah, I think that horror is having definitely a resurgence in terms of commercial viability and respectability. I think people are finally looking at that genre again and saying it sort of doesn't belong in the background. It belongs in the forefront. People love these movies. They represent our fears, right? Your fears say more about you than almost anything else. So they're exciting.
Yeah. What's on the burner for dinner in America as of today?
We're very excited. We have our Midwest premiere, which is going to be here in Ann Arbor at the Michigan Theater on February 27th at 8 p.m. That's through Cinetopia, which is an awesome film festival. They have a direct from Sundance program where they bring two films from Sundance here to Michigan in February, which is way earlier than people normally get to see festival films. So very excited about that.
Awesome.
I just wanted to also say that we have a film that executive produced called The Assistant that I'm very excited about that is opening in Royal Oak at the Main Art on February 14th. And then it's opening in Ann Arbor at the Quality 16 on February 21st.
This is a ripped from the headlines feature about an admin who gets caught up in the web of a predatory executive. And it stars Julia Garner, who people might know from Ozark, and Matthew McFadyen, who's been seen very recently in Succession. How did the production of this film track with what was happening with the Weinstein trial?
So Kitty Green, the writer-director, actually started off working on a project that I think was about the Stanford incident. And she was researching that, and she started to realize that this is a much bigger problem, that there's this sort of these systems set up that allow for systemic abuse to take place.
And so did her development predate the New York Times expose?
It did. And then she sort of pivoted into an office setting because it's a bit more universal. I think people can sort of relate to it more. And also there are so many dynamics in an office that allow for bad people to do bad things and for good people who want to take action to not be able to take action. And so that to me was what was so interesting about the project is that it doesn't focus on a bad person doing bad things. It focuses on how other people are sort of caught up in this trap and how they're really prevented from being able to take action.
The film's getting a lot of attention for obvious reasons right now. What's it making possible for the company?
It's great. I mean, for me to be able to see, as pro-streaming as I am, to be able to see an independent drama like this that I think is important for people to see it get a good theatrical release is so rare. And I think hopefully what that signals to me is that there is an appetite for these films in theaters and that there's also an appetite for films that take a very measured approach to topics that I think people tend to look at in extremes.
Sean O'Grady, thanks for stopping in to talk to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
If you've ever visited the Detroit Institute of Arts, you know that one of the many, many incredible things to be found at the museum is an extensive collection of artwork by African American artists. I had the most amazing conversation this morning with the woman who curates that collection, Valerie Mercer. She's a leader in her field, someone who's changed the way many other museums look at their own collections. We were talking about how very different portraits of black men and women look in the modern era compared with the last 1,000 years of Western civilization.
I think the biggest problems we have in our society today have certainly to do with race still, And a lot of it is because people don't want to know the truth about race, about racism, the truth about history. I think if we keep that up, it can't go well.
Hope you're ready for that full conversation with Valerie Mercer and two other artists working in Detroit right now who we asked to join in to further the conversation. Don't miss tomorrow's show. It's all there. If you can't make it, sign up for the Stateside Radio podcast. You'll be glad you did. Coming up on the show, Michigan's local and county clerks have expressed some concerns about how the tabulation of absentee ballots is going to play out across hundreds of local jurisdictions, your cities, townships, and counties all over the state. Does all that counting have to happen on the day of the election? According to state law, it does. But two bills introduced in the state legislature seek to change that.
Candidates and news media, they camp out at courthouses and clerk's offices to get the immediate result as quickly as possible, as if somehow that changes things to know at 1 a.m. rather than find out at 2 the next day.
We're going to talk through plans for Election Day with a member of the State Senate Elections Committee. Stay with us. That's next on Stateside. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Voters in New Hampshire are headed to the polls today for its first-in-the-nation primary. It's kind of hard to imagine that the voting process could go any worse than things went last week in Iowa. But many local and county clerks here in Michigan are concerned over what our own election night could look like. This will be the first presidential primary and general elections where Michiganders can submit absentee ballots for no reason. And clerks are expecting to see a huge increase of the number of votes that come in that fashion. Without changes in state law to allow more time to count absentee ballots, they argue that there could be a significant delay in providing accurate election results. You might have heard last week on the show, we talked with Tina Barton, clerk for the city of Rochester Hills, and Jan Ronselli, clerk for Bloomfield Township, about their concerns.
Our absentee teams could be spending anywhere from 20 to 24 hours just trying to process the ballots that we have coming in.
And you can't do it all in one day and do it efficiently and accurately without being there for 24 plus hours. That's just not reasonable to ask anybody to do.
State Senator Ruth Johnson, who's also a former Michigan Secretary of State, has introduced a pair of bills to address these concerns. At a recent Senate Elections Committee hearing, State Senator Ed McBroom expressed some reservations about changes. Senator McBroom, Republican from the Upper Peninsula, is with us now. Senator, welcome back to Stateside.
I'm glad to be with you again.
What was your reaction when you first heard about some of the clerk's concerns?
Well, it wasn't so much that I was opposing their concerns. I think that they're very, very legitimate concerns. It's simply the issue of how to solve the problems that, you know, perhaps I wanted to, you know, just add some different perspective to.
During the August 2019 election, that was the first with these new changes allowing more absentee ballots. More than 80% of the votes cast in Rochester Hills were absentee votes. And in Bloomfield Township, it looks like 70% of people who voted cast their ballots absentee. Does this maybe speak to what may be ahead in your eyes?
Absolutely. I think we're going to see a very large absentee voter turnout this coming fall election. We need to be planning ahead for how we're going to deal with this and be prepared for little hiccups and glitches. As long as we maintain the integrity, we're going to have to be very patient with our clerks and the Secretary of State's office that night.
Could you tell me a little bit about what you're expecting to see in Menominee and Dickinson and Delta counties?
Well, Menominee, Dickinson, Delta counties, other UP counties, you know, substantially smaller populations than, you know, Wayne County or Macomb. What we will probably see, though, is our voting staff, our election staff at the polling places will be very busy. I'm accustomed to walking in and seeing, you know, maybe one or two people ahead of me and the staff able to sit, check people in calmly, slowly, and somebody there working the ballots through the ballot box. But I suspect now there's going to be somebody or a couple somebodies constantly feeding absentee ballots through the reader all day at a lot of election places around my area. It gets more complicated in the high population areas where they actually have whole panels assembled to count the absentee ballots because there's so many of them.
For
and that's
sure.
what most of these bills are for.
You had expressed during the hearing that we should keep in mind that hurrying makes room for error and that you'd be comfortable with waiting a couple of days to see what results are. I think the word, why not just, you know, sleep on it or take a nap and see what happens was brought up. Can you say more about what you meant?
Well, I've always been a bit of a contrarian when it comes to election night parties and the angst and so many candidates and news media, the camp out at courthouses and clerk's offices to get the immediate result as quickly as possible, as if somehow that changes things to know at 1 a.m. rather than find out at 2 the next day. I tend to have a perspective that says, you know, we might as well all calm down a little bit. The results are going to be the results. But I find myself much in the minority of that perspective. People just want to know right away. And I just think that we could solve a lot of this problem by just being a lot more calm about it and say, you know, hey, if we find out on Friday, that's okay. My life will continue till then, and it'll continue after them the same, whether I know Tuesday by 8 o'clock or Wednesday morning at 1 a.m.
We're in a place in this country right now where people have been hearing a lot over the past 4 years about efforts to interfere with elections. Now, sometimes what people mean by that is an effort to put up false profiles on Facebook and try to get people thinking different ways about candidates or issues. Sometimes the context of that is hackers who might be trying to hack into vote counting or reporting systems. You know, there's a whole range of things we talk about when we talk about election tampering. But suffice to say that people feel kind of nervous around how the balloting is going to go this year, both in the primary and in the presidential election. Is it possible that a more timely reporting of results is something that bolsters the public trust in fairness and accuracy?
Well, I think what does the most damage is any sort of mistakes or inaccuracies and unpreparedness. You know, I think that, you know, no offense to your fine program, I think that a lot of the drive to say we need to know this right now comes from the media, and it's exciting and it's fun to keep that atmosphere going on, but it doesn't really affect things in the end. Our clerks do a wonderful job. They're resourceful, they're diligent, and if they have to lock up the office at midnight and come back the next day and start counting, I'm confident of the results. But like I said, I'm in the minority of that opinion. So I think, though, when it comes to the security of our elections, Michigan's got an excellent system in place, especially because we continue to use paper with the optical scanners. We're also so separated based on how many different polling sites we have and how you've got the townships working with the county. But everything is dissociated in such a way that hacking and interference and tampering is so unlikely and so unproductive that it's not something that we generally have to be very concerned about. I mean, we have to be diligent. We have to be watchful. But I don't fear the electronic tampering that some people make to be such a big effort. The influence of Facebook and other social media, though, to affecting how people are voting by the promulgation of what seems real but is actually fake and deceptive is a very real problem and something that's a serious problem for the whole nation to deal with right now.
It's a fact that the stakes are higher coming up in March for the Michigan primary for Democratic voters than for Republican voters. The fact that there is a broad range of candidates running for president, as well as candidates for other offices, has certainly lent more urgency to this issue for Democrats. Is it?
Yes.
Could you foresee a situation where there was a wide Republican field where you might feel differently about the timing of the reporting of election results?
No, I've been saying this consistently since I ran for office in 2010 and somebody told me I needed to have an all-night election party to wait for the results and assign somebody to every clerk's office. And I'm like, why. I was just going to go home and take care of my farm and figure out the results in the morning. And, you know, so I've always been a bit of a wet blanket, I suppose, on the whole atmosphere of election night.
So I take it you're a no vote on Senator Johnson's bills?
No, I'm going to vote yes, because the other parts in there, and since nobody wants to do it my way, are really critical. We need to get the folks counting these ballots, or at least opening up the envelopes so they can move through the ballots quickly on election day. We need to do that because nobody wants to take it my way. So I'm going to be a team player and help our clerks out so we can get the elections done safely and soundly on election day. Can't be emphasized enough what a great job our clerks and our Secretary of State's office try to do to make sure our elections are safe and secure. And it can't be repeated enough times that they work very hard. And I hope folks that are listening, if they've got time, will think about working for one of the clerk's offices nearby and help our election process on election day.
Senator McBroom, thank you so much for your time talking to us today about this. We really appreciate it.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Senator Ed McBroom represents Senate District 38, which includes towns like his hometown, Waseda. And by the way, if you'd like to hear our interviews with Tina Barton and Jan Ronselli about their concerns from a clerk's point of view, just head to our website at michiganradio.org/stateside. A recent ad campaign by the Michigan Lottery proudly states that over $1 billion has gone to Michigan schools from lottery profits. However, those dollars are very much in demand, with mounting calls to increase school funding in Michigan and a whole new world of online betting opening up with the potential to change how the lottery's bottom line looks. We were curious to know how much is going to schools right now and how the lottery's money breaks down. With us now is Ben DeGroe from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. He's their education policy director. Ben, good to have you on Stateside.
Good to be with you. Thank you, April.
Ben, when you see that billion-dollar figure, what comes to mind? Do you buy that, or is there a reality gut check somewhere within you?
Well, the billion-dollar figure is a landmark from the lottery's perspective, and when you start talking about numbers that big, people's eyes can glaze over. But it's also helpful for people to know that the lottery funds, while significant, are just one small piece of many that go into the larger school funding pot. So the $1 billion that the lottery puts in is just a piece of nearly $14 billion that the state school aid fund has collected this year. There's a lot of money going to schools and a lot of pieces that are contributing.
The Michigan Lottery's history goes back to the 1970s, and lottery profits were formally added to the school aid fund, I want to say in the early 80s. How would you say they've performed for schools since then?
Well, we are going on 40 years of lottery funds pitching into to schools, and at least at the numbers we can look at in recent years, the lottery funds have consistently made up about 6 to 7% of the state school aid dollars. So it's a consistent and significant piece of the pie, but people's purchases that they're making for sale, the sales tax on those, the income taxes they're paying, and a significant part of property tax as well are all also contributing to those funds as well as many other tax sources.
What can we say about the trajectory of school budgets over the same time? If we look at the big picture and the general fund money that goes to the schools in addition to the school aid fund.
We look back at the last 20 years, Michigan schools experienced some cutbacks during the Great Recession, especially Michigan's deep one-state recession. But coming out of that period in the last 10 years, the state school aid fund has grown by about 43%, which is significantly more than even the rate of inflation that affects how people budget their own dollars. So the trend line is up, and the lottery makes up one significant portion of that.
How does the lottery do in terms of the portion it has to spend on its own administrative costs?
The lottery, by law, has to spend a minimum amount on prize money. Of course, people are playing to win that. And then the overhead makes up somewhere around 10%, I believe. And there are other obligations that the lottery funds have to go to. In the end, that leaves about 25 to 30% of the money that goes in the lottery that they're able to then pass along to the school aid fund in a year. And that's the money that crossed the $1 billion mark this year.
Now, Ben, I know that you are the education policy director, not the legalized gambling director. But there really has been a lot of rumbling lately about how Michigan's entree into legalized online gambling has the potential to affect revenue for schools. Would you say that lawmakers and maybe also Michiganders more generally are pretty comfortable with having this dedicated portion of the education budget coming out of a gambling source?
You don't hear a lot of complaint or pushback out of the legislature about it. Again, as they look at the funds from a variety of, not just the lottery or casino taxes, but the other so-called sin taxes that make up the state school aid fund, the larger concern tends to be how are we going to use the dollars, the growing amount of dollars that are already in the state budget for schools. And so if there's a significant amount of discomfort with where the money is coming from, it's not vocalized very much.
Do you think the lottery has the potential to be something that legislators look back to as they continue to figure out some different revenue streams for education? Do you think there's any capacity to expand this as a revenue base?
The school interests will continue to look for ways to get more money dedicated into the school aid fund, because that's a share of state dollars that other items in the budget can't compete for, like the general fund. So I think there might be an interest in to keep that revenue source available. I don't see anybody advocating for taking away lottery dollars as a source for funding schools. And if it were to go away, then the state would have to find another source of revenue to compensate. So that may be something a future legislature has to deal with. But for now, the current formula has a broad consensus.
I know it's a tough call to think about, maybe the three basic needs in education funding: capital projects, debt that school districts are having to deal with, and operational money. But how would you characterize which of those three is the most pressing need in Michigan right now, and where does lottery money fit into that?
Yeah, so the lottery money goes into the school aid fund, and that funds a lot of pieces of the state budget, but overwhelmingly is helping school districts at the operational level, which is to meet their payrolls and their supplies and keeping the lights on and the buses with fuel and all those things that allow schools to function and run from year to year. The state school aid fund has no real role to play in building projects and renovation projects and facilities. And that's Michigan is one of those states where local voters play the largest role in determining how the school construction projects are going to be financed. So as far as pressing needs, it probably varies from place to place. But the state school aid fund's role is going to be connected mostly to those operational budgets.
Well, as you say, it looks like there won't be any less reliance on the school aid fund in Lansing anytime soon. Well, Ben, thanks for talking to us about this today. Ben DeGroe is Education Policy Director for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. That's our show for today. This episode of Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Peg Watson. Producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and our interns are Leah Baldori and Olive Scott. The executive producer of Stateside is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.